Good morning, everyone. All right. We're going to start this morning off with appeal number 083527, and that is Lawrence versus Astru. And Mr. Duncan?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. Good morning. I'm Dana Duncan. I'm counsel for Mark Lawrence. At issue in this case is the commissioner's burden of proof at step 5 of the sequential process, which is utilized in Social Security. The ALJ found residual functional capacity, which is the benchmark by which the decision is made, which involved some light exertional work with no prolonged standing or walking, occasional bending, squatting, kneeling, climbing, and reaching with no repetitive use of the feet. The ALJ determined that these limitations would preclude Mr. Lawrence's past relevant work at step 4. At that point, the burden of proof then shifts to the commissioner to prove that a significant number of jobs existed in the national economy which Mr. Lawrence could perform given his limitations.
Mr. Duncan,
yes.
As far as I could tell, from the record, the vocational expert testified that he listed only light work that corresponds with the specific RFC limitations in the hypothetical presented by the ALJ. If that is the case, what difference would it make for Lawrence to review the vocational expert's data and distinguish light jobs from sedentary jobs?
Because even if he can still do light jobs, there still has to be a substantial number of those jobs. And in this particular case, the ALJ found that the light jobs he cited, and as you can see from the record, he said they were light, but some of them, in fact, were sedentary, and the numbers that he came up with are what's at issue. Just because he says he can do light work does not mean there's a substantial number of those jobs available.
But you seemed to concede that Lawrence is capable of some sedentary work, and if that is the case, then what would be the harm of any error the ALJ might have made regarding light-duty jobs?
Well, Judge, that's a common mistake that's done in all Social Security. Everybody can work unless you're in a coma. The question is not whether there's jobs available. The question is the number of available jobs. Any individual can go out and perform potentially sedentary work.
And let's get into the numbers here.
All right. In this particular case, Judge, the numbers involved here came from the Occupation Employment Quarterly. And I went to the website for the Occupation Employment Quarterly, found a sample of what their publication does. For example, in the sample that I printed, which is readily available to the court if they wanted to look, it lists helpers, production workers. There are 2,839 of those jobs available. Looking next to it, there are 553 different numbers of Dictionary of Occupational Titles that would correspond with that number. In order for the VE to say that there are 2,839 of those jobs in a given location, he would have to extrapolate how many of those jobs corresponded to the 553 relevant DOT codes.
But here, I mean, our record involves VE testimony that he was conforming the subset of jobs to the limitations, and he identified so many jobs that it seems to me the ball moved back to Mr. Lawrence's court, maybe to do the kind of thing you're even doing right now. But it strikes me that the VE provided testimony on which the ALJ was entitled to rely.
Well, Judge, let me point out, the testimony said, I asked the VE specifically how he determined the number of jobs in each of the specific DOT codes. He indicates that it's from looking at the census codes, looking at the employment statistics within the Wisconsin economy, in terms of the statistical formula, how are you to do that? Well, it isn't true that if there's 8 codes, then there's 10,000 jobs or 8,000 jobs, and the tools using just assumes there are 1,000 jobs. No, it's not that imprecise. In other words, Judge, what we're dealing with here is this uses the census codes, and there is no way without some statistical analysis to translate how these numbers using statistic or the census codes for organizational purposes to translate them to the DOT.
But the VE is the one who does that, actually, and he said that he did it, mm-hmm. and then we wind up with this procedural snafu that occurred when there was a 3-month period of time that went by after the hearing, and Mr. Lawrence didn't send his additional data in. I don't know. It seems to me ALJs rely on VEs to make that kind of a link all the time, and I'm not aware of any rule of law that says they can't look at that kind of census data.
Here's the problem, Judge. In the McKinney case, it clearly states that an applicant is entitled to have produced for him the data that the VE uses.
But there is a timeliness issue here, too. Just because you have a right to something doesn't mean you always have a right, no matter what schedule the court has established.
And if I might just add that there may have been some sort of a technical violation of McKinney, but it would be harmless here because, Mr. Lawrence did not challenge the validity of the VE's conclusions. What's been argued is only that you need the data in order to identify the number of jobs listed by the vocational expert that are light versus the ones that are sedentary. I don't think you've ever challenged the underlying determination that he can do some light work.
Well, the issue, again, Judge, is not that he can do some light or some sedentary work. The issue is the number of jobs available.
15,000. Listed by the VE. We have cases that say 1,400 are enough.
I understand, Judge, but it's not the issue of the number. You have to separate. If the number is wrong, then his testimony is wrong, and it doesn't matter. Because if he comes in and says that he can do light jobs, if it's 5, it's not a significant number. If it's 15, it is a significant number. So the crux of the problem is how does he come up with the numbers 5 or 15? And what I'm arguing and what I've stated is we're basically dealing with a lug nut that's in English, and we're handed a metric wrench, and we're asked to try to figure out exactly how these two match.
And see, I appreciate you have an analogy, but I have the same issues that my sisters here. I just don't see what difference it makes. And I don't think you've really, I don't know, I think your argument is also kind of circular, but I don't think you've really focused in on the real difference it makes.
Well, see,
having that data.
See, even if you had obtained the VE's data and differentiated which jobs were sedentary versus light, the distinction wouldn't have a bearing on the outcome of the case.
It would have.
So the failure to provide the data is basically harmless.
But, Judge, if the data he's using and the methodology he's using is wrong, if the numbers he gives are just created out of whole cloth, then there's a problem.
Where have you come up with the idea that it's created out of whole cloth?
Because without having that, how can I determine whether those numbers are accurate, how that they ever arrived at, how he determined where they came from, how they fit into which category? Without providing that and without being able to articulate it, we just can't do it. VEs are allowed to testify at these administrative hearings in ways that, if they tried to do the same in federal district court, would never be allowed.
Well, that doesn't get you anywhere since the rules are different.
Yeah. I understand. That was made clear in both Donahue and McKinney. But the problem is that, again, without having access to the numbers and being able to do it, we still have that problem. The second point is even if we don't follow that and question that, the other point I raised in this is that clearly the ALJ found that he could do light work. The VE testified as to jobs that were both light and sedentary. He indicated that they fell in between the different classes. Some of the jobs he said were sedentary, some were light, and under Overman, that constitutes a deviation from the DOT anyway, which should still be reversible on those grounds as well.
Well, it seems to me that the ALJ didn't explain a deviation with the DOT because there wasn't no such deviation, but your time is up.
Thank you.
Okay. Seems unfair for me to get the last word, but we'll give you a minute for your rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Siegel. I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this case. There are actually two ways that the court may affirm the ALJ's decision in this case. It can affirm it on the basis of Rule 201.28, which is a grid rule that the ALJ used to establish that the claimant could do a significant number of sedentary jobs, or you can use the vocational expert's testimony in which he identified a significant number of sedentary and light jobs.
Who bears the burden of demonstrating that any limitation a claimant has on the activity of reaching is not significant? In other words, if it's the commissioner's burden and the regulations and cases seem to say that it is, then what evidence in the record here supports a finding that Lawrence's limitation on reaching was not significant?
There are actually a number of medical reports that clarify what his reaching capacity was. We have three consulting physicians, one who examined the claimant, Dr. McPhee, who said that he had unrestricted upper extremity activities. We have two state agency reviewing physicians who would have reviewed the entire medical record, and they also found no restrictions. And then we also have a treating physician, Dr. Smith, who found no limits on reaching, working overhead, or working at shoulder level. So those are all physicians who found no limits on the claimant's reaching. The only actual medical evidence we have of an occasional reaching limit is from a physical therapist. And in the context of her report, her reaching limit would be consistent with sedentary work, because she explained that her occasional or her reaching limitations had to do with concerns over body mechanics. And the claimant has a back impairment, so reaching overhead might aggravate his back at a certain level. And she said that the claimant was capable of lifting 15 pounds overhead maximum and occasionally lifting 7 pounds overhead. And that would be consistent with the definition of sedentary work, which requires no more than 10 pounds of lifting maximum and only occasional lifting of small objects like docket files and small tools, that kind of thing. So even though she did say there was an occasional lifting limit, she was thinking in terms of a much greater weight, which would not be required by a sedentary job. So that non-exertional limitation would actually be consistent with sedentary work.
So it's essentially, if I understand it, the commissioner's position that no one's contesting that he can do sedentary work, at least, and that there were enough sedentary jobs that the VE identified, that
yes,
there really isn't much going on here?
And actually, I did want to clarify a little bit about the vocational expert's testimony. The vocational expert actually identified jobs that fell in both the light and sedentary category. The general office clerk job that he identified, for example, he gave two DOT numbers that one corresponded with light, one corresponded with sedentary. The information clerk, the bookkeeping clerk, and the industrial inspector also had categories that were light and sedentary. Rather, the industrial inspector was just sedentary, but some of the jobs had DOT numbers in both categories. But that would make sense because the vocational expert was looking at a hypothetical question that did encompass both sedentary and light work, a range of sedentary work and a partial range of light work. I think he said just sedentary work and a partial range of light work is what the ALJ said.
Mm-hmm.
So the
ALJ's RFC limits Mr. Lawrence to occasional reaching.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
It didn't indicate anything about direction, like reaching overhead or reaching.
No, he didn't. But the only record evidence that talks about that is the physical therapist, and he cites the physical therapist in his decision, and really that would be where he was getting it from. And in fact, the hypothetical actually took word for word from the physical therapist's residual functional capacity assessment. I would just like to talk briefly about the vocational expert sources. The claimant makes a tremendous deal about the occupational employment quarterly numbers, but that's not the only thing that the vocational expert relied on. This vocational expert was actually a rehabilitation counselor and a vocational rehabilitation specialist. He has 20 years of experience, and he specifically said that in addition to getting numbers from census codes and from Wisconsin economy employment statistics, he also relied on interviews that he did in the field at job sites with people he was trying to place in jobs. So he's drawing on all that expertise when he's testifying as a vocational expert. And I think as the court understands, just given the statements that were made, this is something that vocational experts do, and this is something that ALJs are called to rely upon. That's why they call vocational experts instead of just trying to do the statistical analysis themselves, because the raw data often doesn't really explain what jobs are actually out there. And that is how the vocational expert made his testimony, is by drawing on all these different sources, not just the statistical sources, but from also his experience.
Now, it does seem to me that the point Mr. Duncan is making, even if we don't go all the way to Rule 702 and Daubert, this isn't the only Social Security case I've seen where the vocational expert's testimony comes across as fairly conclusory. I realize he says the words, you know, I'm relying on my experience. You can look at his CV and see that he has experience. Mm-hmm. But it's a little hard for somebody to probe that without more detail.
And I think an attempt was made at the hearing. He did start talking about the occupation employment quarterly, and at one point the vocational expert asked if the claimant's attorney was looking for a statistical formula. And that question was really never answered by the claimant's attorney, and he seemed to go on to another issue and kind of talked about how, well, do you just divide the number in to the big number, the little number into the big number, and the vocational expert said, no, it's not that simple, it's not that precise. But then he never followed up on it, and that's something that if the claimant's attorney was really interested in getting a statistical formula, then he could have asked for it. There was a time at the hearing that he could have gotten that. And in the Liskowitz case, which the court recently decided, the court said that they do have to ask for these things at the hearing. If they don't ask for them, it's too late. If they don't ask for them, until much later, it's too late. At the point that the claimant's attorney asked for it 3 months later, any kind of statistical reports or notes that the vocational expert had used to prepare his testimony would likely have been gone. And it would probably have been impossible to bring it back all together. There's who knows where the file would have been at that point.
And then the ALJ left the record open for 30 days.
That's correct. He did. He left it open for 30 days.
And that just wasn't limited to the MRI scans, was it?
That's right. He said anything else could come in as well. If you have no further questions, I would just request that the court affirm the commissioner's decision.
Mr. Duncan, you used your rebuttal time, but I'm going to give you a minute.
Thank you, Donna. Sure. Just a couple of points briefly. There's been mention about the 30 days and the 90 days issue. It is not uncommon in these. I've had over 100 hearings this year It's not uncommon if you're asking for additional medical records to call the ALJ and ask for additional time. The fact that the ALJ never objected in his decision to the timeliness of the 90 days would evidence, in my opinion, that there was no objection on their part and they've waived any objection on timeliness of these issues. The second point that I would like to make is that the whole concept about this, the council made about the 15-pound overhead coming into play as sedentary. Sedentary is 10 pounds, as she's indicated, and 15 pounds is more than sedentary limitations. Under SSR 8310, which defines the sedentary and light restrictions, it goes on to say that if you can't perform substantially all of the limitations of that exertional level, then you have to go a step down. So therefore, the limitation should have been sedentary in and of itself. So, and there is no equation that you can say lifting 15 pounds overhead equals out to sedentary limitations. I would lastly just point out briefly this, that Appendix C of the Selective Characteristics of Occupations is the document that supplements the DOT, and that is where reaching comes into play, and it is defined as reaching in any direction, so it makes no difference if it's up, down, out, across, or wherever. Reaching is reaching, and there's only three occupations where occasional reaching is allowed in the entire DOT's SCO. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Ms. Siegel, the case will be taken under advisement. We're going to go on.